Side 4, Count Zero, by William Gibson. Continuing on page 111. This ran directly opposite to the rule around Big Playground, where kids who had no real clout whatever went to great pains to advertise their chrome-studded rabidity, which probably did them some good, at least in terms of the local action. But Lucas was very clearly nothing to do with local action. "I see you doubt it," Lucas said. "Well, you'll probably find out soon enough, but not for a while. The way your life's going now, things should remain new and exciting for quite a while." The elevator door shuddered open, and Lucas was moving, shooing Bobby in front of him like a child. They stepped out into a tiled foyer that seemed to stretch forever, past kiosks and cloth-draped stalls and people squatting beside blankets with things spread out on them. "But not to linger," Lucas said, giving Bobby a very gentle shove with one large hand when Bobby paused in front of stacks of jumbled software. "You are on your way to the sprawl, my man, and you are going in a manner that befits a count."
"How's that?"
"In a limo." Lucas's car was an amazing stretch of gold-flecked black bodywork and mirror-finished brass, studded with a collection of Baroque gadgets whose purpose Bobby only had time to guess at. One of the things was a dish antenna, he decided, but it looked more like one of those Aztec calendar wheels, and then he was inside, Lucas letting the wide door clunk gently shut behind them. The windows were tinted so dark it looked like nighttime outside, a bustling nighttime where the project's crowds went about their noonday business. The interior of the vehicle was a single large compartment, padded with bright rugs and pale leather cushions, although there seemed to be no particular place to sit. No steering wheel either. The dash was a padded expanse of leather, unbroken by controls of any kind. He looked at Lucas, who was loosening his black tie.
"How do you drive it?"
"Sit down anywhere. You drive it like this. Ahmed, get our asses to New York, Lower East." The car slid smoothly away from the curb as Bobby dropped to his knees on a soft pile of rugs. "Lunch will be served in 30 minutes, sir, unless you'd care for something sooner," a voice said. It was soft, melodious, and seemed to come from nowhere in particular. Lucas laughed. "They really knew how to build 'em in Damascus," he said.
"Where?"
"Damascus," Lucas said, as he unbuttoned his suit coat and settled back into a wedge of pale cushions. "This is a Rolls, old one. Those Arabs built a good car while they had the money." "Lucas," Bobby said, his mouth half full of cold fried chicken, "how come it's taking us an hour and a half to get to New York? We aren't exactly crawling." "Because," Lucas said, pausing for another sip of cold white wine, "that's how long it's taking us. Ahmed has all the factory options, including a first-rate counter-surveillance system. On the road, rolling, Ahmed provides a remarkable degree of privacy, more than I'm ordinarily willing to pay for in New York. Ahmed, you get the feeling anybody's trying to get to us, listen in or anything?"
"No, sir," the voice said.
8 minutes ago our identification panel was infrascanned by a tactical helicopter. The helicopter's number was MH-3-848, piloted by Corporal Roberto..."
"Okay, okay," Lucas said.
"Fine, never mind.
You see?
Ahmed got more on those tacks than they got on us." He wiped his hands on a thick white linen napkin and took a gold toothpick from his jacket pocket. "Lucas," Bobby said, while Lucas probed delicately at the gaps between his big square teeth, "what would happen if, say, I asked you to take me to Times Square and let me out?"
"Ah," Lucas said, lowering the toothpick, "the city's most resonant acre.
What's the matter, Bobby? A drug problem?"
"Well, no, but I was wondering."
"Wondering what? You want to go to Times Square?"
"No, that was just the first place I thought of. What I mean is, I guess, would you let me go?"
"No," Lucas said, "not to put too fine a point on it. But you don't have to think of yourself as a prisoner. More like a guest, a valued guest."
Bobby smiled wanly.
Oh, okay. Like what they call protective custody, I guess.
Right, Lucas said, bringing the gold toothpick into play again.
And while we are here, securely screened by the good Ahmed, it's time we have a talk. Brother Beauvoir has already told you a little about us, I think. What do you think, Bobby, about what he's told you?
Well, Bobby said, it's real interesting, but I'm not sure I understand it.
What don't you understand?
Well, I don't know about this voodoo stuff.
Lucas raised his eyebrows. I mean, it's your business, what you want to buy. I mean, believe, right? But one minute Beauvoir's talking biz, street tech, like I never heard before, and the next he's talking mambos and ghosts and snakes
And what?
Horses, Bobby said, his throat tight.
Bobby, do you know what a metaphor is?
A component, like a capacitor?
No.
Never mind metaphor, then.
When Beauvoir or I talk to you about the Loa and their horses, as we call those few the Loa choose to ride, you should pretend that we are talking two languages at once. One of them you already understand. That's the language of street tech, as you call it. We may be using different words, but we're talking tech. Maybe we call something Ugo Ferrai, that you might call an icebreaker, you understand? But at the same time, with the same words, we are talking about other things. And that, you don't understand. You don't need to.
He put his toothpick away. Bobby took a deep breath. Beauvoir said that Jackie's a horse for a snake called Danbala. You run that by me in street tech?
Certainly. Think of Jackie as a deck, Bobby. A cyberspace deck. A very pretty one with nice ankles.
Lucas grinned and Bobby blushed. Think of Danbala, who some people call the snake, as a program. Say, as an icebreaker. Danbala slots into the Jackie deck. Jackie cuts ice. That's all.
Okay, Bobby said, getting the hang of it. Then what's the Matrix? If she's a deck and Danbala's a program, what's cyberspace?
The world, Lucas said.
Best if we walk from here, Lucas said. The rolls came to a silent silken halt, and Lucas stood, buttoning his suit coat. Ahmed attracts too much attention. He picked up his cane, and the door made a soft chunking sound as it unlocked itself. Bobby climbed down behind him, into the unmistakable signature smell of the sprawl, a rich amalgam of stale subway exhalations, ancient soot, and the carcinogenic tang of fresh plastics, all of it shot through with the carbon edge of illicit fossil fuels. High overhead, in the reflected glare of arc lamps, one of the unfinished Fuller domes shut out two-thirds of the salmon-pink evening sky, its ragged edge like broken gray honeycomb. The sprawl's patchwork of domes tended to generate inadvertent microclimates. There were areas of a few city blocks where a fine drizzle of condensation fell continually from the soot-stained geodesics, and sections of high dome famous for displays of static discharge, a peculiarly urban variety of lightning. There was a stiff wind blowing as Bobby followed Lucas down the street, a warm, gritty breeze that probably had something to do with pressure shifts in the sprawl-long subway system.
Remember what I told you, Lucas said, his eyes narrowed against the grit. The man is far more than he seems. Even if he were nothing more than what he seems, you would owe him a degree of respect. If you want to be a cowboy, you're about to meet a landmark in the trade.
Yeah, right. He skipped to avoid a graying length of printout that tried to wrap itself around his ankle. So he's the one you and Beauvoir bought the...
Ha! No. Remember what I told you. You speak in the open street. You may as well put your words up on a bulletin board.
Bobby grimaced, then nodded.
Shit. He kept blowing it. Here he was with a major operator. Up to his neck in some amazing kind of biz, and he kept acting like a Wilson.
Operator. That was the word for Lucas, and for Beauvoir, too.
And that voodoo talk was just some game they ran on people, he'd decided. In the roles, Lucas had launched into some strange extended number about Legba, who he said was the Loa of communication, the master of roads and pathways, all about how the man he was taking Bobby to meet was a favorite of Legba's. When Bobby asked if the man was another Ungan, Lucas said no. He said the man had walked with Legba all his life, so close that he'd never known the Loa was there at all, like it was just a part of him, his shadow. And this was the man, Lucas had said, who'd sold them the software that Tuaday had rented to Bobby. Lucas rounded a corner and stopped, Bobby close behind. They stood in front of a blackened brownstone whose windows had been sealed decades before with sheets of corrugated steel. Part of the ground floor had once been a shop of some kind, its cracked display windows opaque with grime. The door, between the blind windows, had been reinforced with the same steel that sealed the windows of the upper floors, and Bobby thought he could make out some sort of sign behind the window to his left, discarded neon script tilted diagonally in the gloom. Lucas just stood there, facing the doorway, his face expressionless, the tip of his cane planted neatly on the sidewalk, and his large hands one atop the other on the brass knob. "First thing you learn," he said with the tone of a man reciting a proverb, "is that you always gotta wait." Bobby thought he heard something scrape behind the door, and then there was a rattle like chains. "Amazing," Lucas said. "Almost as though we were expected." The door swung 10 centimeters on well-oiled hinges and seemed to catch on something. An eye regarded them, unblinking, suspended there in that crack of dust and dark, and at first it seemed to Bobby that it must be the eye of some large animal, the iris a strange shade of brownish yellow, and the whites, mottled and shot through with red, the lower lid gaping redder still below.
"Hoodoo man," said the invisible face the eye belonged to.
Then, "Hoodoo man and some little lump of shit. Jesus." There was an awful gurgling sound as of antique phlegm being drawn up from hidden recesses, and then the man spat.
"Well, move it, Lucas."
There was another grating sound, and the door swung inward on the dark.
"I'm a busy man."
This last from a meter away, receding, as though the eye's owner were scurrying from the light admitted by the open door. Lucas stepped through, Bobby on his heels, Bobby feeling the door swing smoothly shut behind him. The sudden darkness brought the hairs on his forearms up. It felt alive, that dark, cluttered and dense and somehow sentient. Then a match flared and some sort of pressure lamp hissed and spat as the gas in its mantle ignited. Bobby could only gape at the face beyond the lantern, where the bloodshot yellow eye waited with its mate in what Bobby would very much have liked to believe was a mask of some kind.
"I don't suppose you were expecting us, were you, Finn?" Lucas asked. "You want to know," the face said, revealing large, flat yellow teeth. "I was on my way out to find something to eat."
He looked to Bobby as though he could survive on a diet of moldering carpet, or burrow patiently through the brown wood pulp of the damp swollen books stacked shoulder high on either side of the tunnel where they stood.
"Who's the little shit, Lucas?"
"You know, Finn, Beauvoir and I are experiencing difficulties with something we acquired from you in good faith." Lucas extended his cane and prodded delicately at a dangerous-looking overhang of crumbling paperbacks.
"Are you now?"
The Finn pursed his gray lips in mock concern. "Don't fuck with those first editions, Lucas. You bring 'em down, you pay for 'em." Lucas withdrew the cane. Its polished ferrule flashed in the lantern glare.
"So," the Finn said, "you got problems."
"Funny thing, Lucas. Funny fucking thing." His cheeks were grayish, seamed with deep diagonal creases.
"I got some problems, too. 3 of them. I didn't have them this morning. I guess that's just the way life is sometimes."
He put the hissing lantern down on a gutted steel filing cabinet and fished a bent, unfiltered cigarette from a side pocket of something that might once have been a tweed jacket.
My three problems, they're upstairs. Maybe you want to have a look at them.
He struck a wooden match on the base of the lantern and lit his cigarette. The pungent reek of black Cuban tobacco gathered in the air between them.
You know, the Finn said, stepping over the first of the bodies, I've been at this location a long time. Everybody knows me. They know I'm here. You buy from the Finn, you know who you're buying from. And I stand behind my product every time.
Bobby was staring down at the upturned face of the dead man, at the eyes gone dull. There was something wrong with the shape of the torso, wrong with the way it lay there in the black clothes. Japanese face, no expression, dead eyes.
And all that time, the Finn continued, you know how many people ever dumb enough to try to get in here to take me off? None. Not one. Not till this morning. And I get fucking three already.
Well, he shot Bobby a hostile glance. That's not counting the odd little lump of shit, I guess, but...
He shrugged.
He looks kind of lopsided, Bobby said, still staring at the first corpse.
That's 'cause he's dog food inside, the Finn leered. All mashed up.
The Finn collects exotic weapons, Lucas said, nudging the wrist of a second body with the tip of his cane.
Have you scanned them for implants, Finn?
Yeah, pain in the butt.
Had to carry them downstairs to the back room. Nothing, other than what you'd expect. They're just a hit team.
He sucked his teeth noisily.
Why does anybody want to hit me?
Maybe you sold them a very expensive product that wouldn't do its job, Lucas volunteered.
I hope you aren't saying you sent them, Lucas, the Finn said levelly. Unless you want to see me do the dog food trick.
Did I say you'd sold us something that doesn't work?
Experiencing difficulties, you said. And what else have you guys bought from me recently?
Sorry, Finn, but they're not ours. You know it, too.
Yeah, I guess I do. So what the fuck's got you down here, Lucas? You know that stuff you bought wasn't covered by the usual guarantees.
You know, said the Finn, after listening to the story of Bobby's abortive cyberspace run, that's some weird shit out there. He slowly shook his narrow, strangely elongated head. Didn't used to be this way. He looked at Lucas. You people know, don't you? They were seated around a square white table in a white room on the ground floor, behind the junk-clogged storefront. The floor was scuffed hospital tile, molded in a non-slip pattern, and the walls broad slabs of dingy white plastic concealing dense layers of anti-bugging circuitry. Compared to the storefront, the white room seemed surgically clean. Several alloy tripods bristling with sensors and scanning gear stood around the table like abstract sculpture.
"Know what?" Bobby asked. With each retelling of his story, he felt less like a Wilson. Important. It made him feel important.
Not you, pisshead, the Finn said wearily. Him. Big hoodoo man. He knows. Knows it's not the same. Hasn't been. Not for a long time. I've been in the trade forever. Way back. Before the war. Before there was any Matrix. Or anyway, before people knew there was one.
He was looking at Bobby now.
I got a pair of shoes older than you are, so what the fuck should I expect you to know? There were cowboys ever since there were computers. They built the first computers to crack German ice, right? Code breakers. So there was ice before computers, you want to look at it that way.
He lit his 15th cigarette of the evening, and smoke began to fill the white room.
Lucas knows, yeah. The last 7-8 years, there's been... funny stuff out there, out on the console cowboy circuit. The new jockeys, they make deals with things, don't they, Lucas?
Yeah, you bet I know.
They still need the hard and the soft, and they still gotta be faster than snakes on ice, but all of them,
All the ones who really know how to cut it. They got allies, don't they, Lucas?
Lucas took his gold toothpick out of his pocket and began to work on a rear molar, his face dark and serious.
"Thrones and dominions," the Finn said obscurely.
"Yeah, there's things out there. Ghosts, voices. Why not? Oceans had mermaids, all that shit. And we had a sea of silicon, see? Sure, it's just a tailored hallucination we all agreed to have, cyberspace. But anybody who jacks in knows, fucking knows, it's a whole universe. And every year it gets a little more crowded, sounds like."
"For us," Lucas said, "the world has always worked that way."
"Yeah," the Finn said. "So you guys could slot right into it. Tell people the things you were cutting deals with were your same old bush god.
Divine horsemen."
"Sure, maybe you believe it. But I'm old enough to remember when it wasn't like that. 10 years ago, you went in the gentleman loser and tried telling any of the top jocks you talked with ghosts in the Matrix. They'd have figured you were crazy."
"A Wilson," Bobby put in, feeling left out and no longer as important.
The Finn looked at him blankly.
"A what?"
"A Wilson. A fuck-up. It's hot dogger talk, I guess."
"Did it again. Shit."
The Finn gave him a very strange look.
"Jesus. That's your word for it, huh? Christ, I know the guy."
"Who?"
"Bodine Wilson," he said. "First guy I ever knew wound up as a figure of speech."
"Was he stupid?" Bobby asked, immediately regretting it.
"Stupid? Shit, no. He was smart as hell."
The Finn stubbed his cigarette out in a cracked ceramic Campari ashtray. "Just a total fuck-up was all. He worked with the Dixie Flatline once." The bloodshot yellow eyes grew distant.
"Finn," Lucas said, "where did you get that icebreaker you sold us?"
The Finn regarded him bleakly.
40 years in the business, Lucas. You know how many times I've been asked that question? You know how many times I'd be dead if I'd answered it?"
Lucas nodded.
"I take your point. But at the same time, I put one to you."
He held the toothpick out toward the Finn like a toy dagger. "The real reason you're willing to sit here and bullshit is that you think those three stiffs upstairs have something to do with the icebreaker you sold us. And you sat up and took special notice when Bobby told you about his mother's condo getting wiped, didn't you?"
The Finn showed teeth.
"Maybe."
"Somebody's got you on. He's a colleague of mine in those days. Dealt mostly art and collectibles. He sees it and wants it. So we do some dipshit deal. 'Any more of these, Finn,' he says. 'Get 'em. There's assholes uptown go for this kind of shit.' So the next time a guy turned up from the Wig, I bought the sculpture thing, too, and traded it to Smith. But it was never much money for any of it."
The Finn shrugged.
"Not until last month, anyway. Some kid came in with what you bought. It was from the Wig. 'Listen,' he says, 'this is Biosoft, and it's a breaker. Wig says it's worth a lot.' I put a scan on it, and it looked right. I thought it looked interesting, you know. Your partner, Beauvoir, thought it looked pretty interesting, too. I bought it. Beauvoir bought it off me. End of story."
The Finn dragged out a cigarette, this one broken, bent double.
"Shit," he said.
He pulled a faded pack of cigarette papers from the same pocket and extracted one of the fragile pink leaves, rolling it tightly around the broken cigarette, a sort of splint. When he licked the glue, Bobby caught a glimpse of a very pointed, gray-pink tongue.
"And where, Finn, does Mr. Wig reside?" Lucas asked, his thumbs beneath his chin, his large fingers forming a steeple in front of his face.
"Lucas, I haven't got the slightest fucking clue. In orbit somewhere. And modestly, if the kind of money he was getting out of me meant anything to him. You know, I hear there's places up there where you don't need money, if you fit into the economy. So maybe a little goes a long way. Don't ask me, though. I'm agoraphobic.
He smiled nastily at Bobby, who was trying to get the image of that tongue out of his mind. "You know," he said, squinting at Lucas, "it was about that time that I started hearing about weird shit happening in the Matrix."
"Like what?" Bobby asked.
"Keep the fuck out of this," the Finn said, still looking at Lucas. "That was before you guys turned up, the new hoodoo team. I knew this street samurai, got a job working for a special forces type, made the wig look flat fucking normal. Her and this cowboy they'd scraped up out of Chiba, they were onto something like that. Maybe they found it. Istanbul was the last I saw of them. Heard she lived in London once, a few years ago. Who the fuck knows? 7, 8 years.
The Finn suddenly seemed tired and old, very old. He looked to Bobby like a big mummified rat animated by springs and hidden wires. He took a wristwatch with a cracked face and a single greasy leather strap from his pocket and consulted it.
"Jesus. Well, that's all you get from me, Lucas. I've got some friends from an organ bank coming by in 20 minutes to talk a little biz."
Bobby thought of the bodies upstairs. They'd been there all day.
"Hey," the Finn said, reading the expression on his face, "organ banks are great for getting rid of things. I'm paying them. Those motherless assholes upstairs, they don't have too much left in the way of organs."
And the Finn laughed.
"You said he was close to Legba? And Legba's the one you and Beauvoir said gave me luck when I hit that black ice?"
Beyond the honeycomb edge of the geodesics, the sky was lightening.
"Yes," Lucas said. He seemed lost in thought. "But he doesn't seem to trust that stuff at all."
"It doesn't matter," Lucas said as the rolls came into view. "He's always been close to the spirit of the thing."
17. The Squirrel Wood. The plane had gone to ground near the sound of running water. Turner could hear it, turning in the G-web in his fever or sleep. "Water Down Stone," one of the oldest songs. The plane was smart, smart as any dog, with hardwired instincts of concealment. He felt it sway on its landing gear, somewhere in the sick night, and creep forward, branches brushing and scraping against the dark canopy. The plane crept into deep green shadow and sank down on its knees, its airframe whining and creaking as it flattened itself, belly down, into loam and granite, like a manta ray into sand. The mimetic polycarbon coating its wings and fuselage mottled and darkened, taking on the colors and patterns of moon-dappled stone and forest soil. Finally, it was silent, and the only sound was the sound of water over a creek bed. He came awake like a machine, eyes opening, vision plugged in, empty, remembering the red flash of Lynch's death out beyond the fixed sights of the Smith & Wesson. The arc of the canopy above him was laced with mimetic approximations of leaves and branches, pale dawn and the sound of running water. He was still wearing Oki's blue work shirt. It smelled of sour sweat now, and he'd ripped the sleeves out the day before. The gun lay between his legs, pointing at the jet's black joystick. The G-web was a limp tangle around his hips and shoulders. He twisted around and saw the girl, oval face and a brown, dried trickle of blood beneath a nostril. She was still out, sweating, her lips slightly parted, like a doll's.
"Where are we?"
"We are 15 meters south-southeast of the landing coordinates you provided," the plane said. "You were unconscious again. I opted for concealment." He reached back and removed the interface plug from his socket, breaking his link with the plane. He gazed dully around the cockpit until he found the manual controls for the canopy. It sighed up on servos, the lacework of polycarbon leaves shifting as it moved. He got his leg over the side, looked down at his hand flat against the fuselage at the edge of the cockpit. Polycarbon reproduced the gray tones of a nearby boulder. As he watched, it began to paint a hand-sized patch the color of his palm. He pulled his other leg over, the gun forgotten on the seat, and slid down into earth and long sweet grass. Then he slept again, his forehead against the grass, and dreamed of running water. When he woke, he was crawling forward on his hands and knees, through low branches heavy with dew. Finally, he reached a clearing and pitched forward, rolling over, his arms spread in what felt like surrender. High above him, something small and gray launched itself from one branch, caught another, swung there for an instant, then scrambled away out of his sight. "Lie still," he heard a voice telling him, years away. "Just lay out and relax, and pretty soon they'll forget you. Forget you in the gray and the dawn and the dew. They're out to feed. Feed and play, and their brains can't hold two messages, not for long." He lay there on his back, beside his brother, the nylon-stocked Winchester across his chest, breathing the smell of new brass and gun oil, the smell of their campfire still in his hair. And his brother was always right about the squirrels. They came. They forgot the clear glyph of death spelled out below them in patched denim and blue steel. They came, racing along limbs, pausing to sniff the morning. And Turner's .22 cracked, a limp gray body tumbling down. The others scattered, vanishing, and Turner passed the gun to his brother. Again they waited, waited for the squirrels to forget them. "You're like me," Turner said to the squirrels, bobbing up out of his dream. One of them sat up suddenly on a fat limb and looked directly at him. "I always come back." The squirrel hopped away. "I was coming back when I ran from the Dutchman. I was coming back when I flew to Mexico. I was coming back when I killed Lynch." He lay there for a long time, watching the squirrels, while the woods woke and the morning warmed around him. A crow swept in, banking, breaking with feathers it spread like black mechanical fingers, checking to see if he were dead. Turner grinned up at the crow as it flapped away. "Not yet." He crawled back in, under the overhanging branches, and found her sitting up in the cockpit. She wore a baggy white T-shirt slashed diagonally with the Mass Neotech logo. There were lozenges of fresh red blood across the front of the shirt. Her nose was bleeding again. Bright blue eyes, dazed and disoriented, in sockets bruised yellow-black, like exotic makeup. Young, he saw. Very young. "You're Mitchell's daughter," he said, dragging the name up from the Biosoft dossier. "Angela." "Angie," she said automatically. "Who are you? I'm bleeding." She held out a bloody carnation of wadded tissue. "Turner, I was expecting your father." Remembering the gun now, her other hand out of sight below the edge of the cockpit. "Do you know where he is?"
"In the mesa. He thought he could talk with them, explain it, because they need him."
"With who?" He took a step forward.
"Mass, the board. They can't afford to hurt him, can they?"
"Why would they?" Another step. She dabbed at her nose with the red tissue.
"Because he sent me out. Because he knew they were going to hurt me. Kill me, maybe. Because of the dreams."
"The dreams?"
"Do you think they'll hurt him?"
"No. No, they wouldn't do that. I'm going to climb up there now, okay?" She nodded. He had to run his hands over the side of the fuselage to find the shallow, recessed handholds. The mimetic coating showed him leaf and lichen, twigs. And then he was up, beside her, and he saw the gun beside her sneakered foot. "But wasn't he coming himself? I was expecting him, your father."
"No, we never planned that. We only had the one plane. Didn't he tell you?"
She started to shake.
"Didn't he tell you anything?"
"Enough," he said, putting his hand on her shoulder. "He told us enough. It'll be all right." He swung his legs over, bent, moved the Smith & Wesson away from her foot, and found the interface cable. His hand still on her, he raised it, snapped it into place behind his ear. "Give me the procedures for erasing anything you stored in the past 48 hours," he said.
I want to dump that course for Mexico City, your flight from the coast, anything. There was no plan logged for Mexico City, the voice said, direct neural input on audio. Turner stared at the girl, rubbed his jaw. Where were we going? Bogota. And the jet reeled out coordinates for the landing they hadn't made. She blinked at him, her lids bruised dark as the surrounding skin.
Who are you talking to?
The plane. Did Mitchell tell you where he thought you'd be going?
Japan.
Know anyone in Bogota? Where's your mother?
No, Berlin, I think. I don't really know her.
He wiped the plane's banks, dumping Conroy's programming, what there was of it. The approach from California, identification data for the site, a flight plan that would have taken them to a strip within 300 kilometers of Bogota's urban core. Someone would find the jet eventually. He thought about the mass orbital recon system and wondered if the stealth and evasion programs he'd ordered the plane to run had done any real good. He could offer the jet to Rudy for salvage, but he doubted Rudy would want to be involved. For that matter, simply showing up at the farm, with Mitchell's daughter in tow, dragged Rudy in right up to his neck. But there was nowhere else to go, not for the things he needed now. It was a 4-hour walk along half-remembered trails and down a weed-grown, winding stretch of 2-lane blacktop. The trees were different, it seemed to him, and then he remembered how much they would have grown over the years since he'd been back. At regular intervals, they passed the stumps of wooden poles that had once supported telephone wires, overgrown now with bramble and honeysuckle, the wires pulled down for fuel. Bees grazed in flowering grass at the roadside.
Is there food where we're going?
The girl asked, the soles of her white sneakers scuffing the weathered blacktop. Sure, Turner said. All you want.
What I want right now is water.
She swiped a lank strand of brown hair back from a tanned cheek. He'd noticed she was developing a limp, and she'd started to wince each time she put her right foot down. What's wrong with your leg?
Ankle.
Something, I think when I decked the light. She grimaced, kept walking. We'll rest.
No, I want to get there. Get anywhere.
Rest, he said, taking her hand, leading her to the edge of the road. She made a face, but sat down beside him, her right leg stretched carefully in front of her.
That's a big gun, she said.
It was hot now, too hot for the parka. He put the shoulder rig on bareback, with the sleeveless work shirt over it, tails out and flapping.
Why does the barrel look like that, like a cobra's head underneath?
That's a sighting device, for night fights. He leaned forward to examine her ankle. It was swelling quickly now. I don't know how much longer you'll want to walk on that, he said.
You get into a lot of fights at night? With guns?
No.
I don't think I understand what it is that you do.
He looked up at her. I don't always understand that myself, not lately. I was expecting your father. He wanted to change companies, work for somebody else. The people he wanted to work for hired me and some other people to make sure he got out of his old contract.
But there wasn't any way out of that contract, she said. Not legally.
That's right. Undoing the knot, unlacing the sneaker. Not legally.
Oh. So that's what you do for a living?
Yes. Sneaker off now. She wore no sock, the ankle swelling badly. This is a sprain.
What about the other people, then? You had more people back there, in that ruin. Somebody was shooting, and those flares.
Hard to say who was shooting, he said, but the flares weren't ours. Maybe Mas security team, following you out. Did you think you got out clean?
I did what Chris told me, she said. Chris, that's my father.
I know. I think I'm going to have to carry you the rest of the way.
But what about your friends?
What friends?
Back there, in Arizona.
Right. Well,
and he wiped sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand. Can't say. Don't really know. Seeing the white-out sky, flare of energy, brighter than the sun, but no pulse of electromagnetics, the plane had said. The first of Rudy's augmented dogs picked them up 15 minutes after they started out again. Angie riding Turner's back, arms around his shoulders, skinny thighs under his armpits, his fingers locked in front of his sternum in a double fist. She smelled like a kid from the upline burbs, some vaguely herbal hint of soap or shampoo. Thinking that, he thought about what he must smell like to her. Rudy had a shower.
Oh, shit, what's that?
Stiffening on his back, pointing. A lean gray hound regarded them from a high clay bank at a turning in the road, its narrow head sheathed and blindered in a black hood studded with sensors. It panted, tongue lolling, and slowly swung its head from side to side. It's okay, Turner said. Watchdog. Belongs to my friend. The house had grown, sprouting wings and workshops, but Rudy had never painted the peeling clapboard of the original structure. Rudy had thrown up a taut square of chain link since Turner's time, fencing away his collection of vehicles, but the gate was open when they arrived, the hinges lost in morning glory and rust. The real defenses, Turner knew, were elsewhere. Four of the augmented hounds trotted after him as he trudged up the gravel drive, Angie's head limp on his shoulder, her arms still locked around him. Rudy was waiting on the front porch, in old white shorts and a navy t-shirt, its single pocket displaying at least 9 pins of one kind or another. He looked at them and raised a green can of Dutch beer in greeting. Behind him, a blonde in a faded khaki shirt stepped out of the kitchen, a chrome spatula in her hand. Her hair was clipped short, swept up and back in a cut that made Turner think of the Korean medic in Hosaka's pod, of the pod burning, of Weber, of the white sky. He swayed there, in Rudy's gravel driveway, legs wide to support the girl, his bare chest streaked with sweat, with dust from the mall in Arizona, and looked at Rudy and the blonde. "We got some breakfast for you," Rudy said. "When you came up on the dog screens, we figured you'd be hungry." His tone was carefully noncommittal. The girl groaned. "That's good," Turner said. "She's got a bum ankle, Rudy. We better look at that. Some other things I have to talk to you about, too." "Little young for you, I'd say," Rudy said, and took another swig of his beer. "Fuck off, Rudy," the woman beside him said. "Can't you see she's hurt? Bring her in this way," she said to Turner, and was gone, back through the kitchen door. "You look different," Rudy said, peering at him, and Turner saw that he was drunk. "The same, but different." "It's been a while," Turner said, starting for the wooden steps. "You get a face job or something?" "Reconstruction. They had to build it back from records." He climbed the steps, his lower back stabbed through with pain at every move. "It's not bad," Rudy said. "I almost didn't notice." He belched. He was shorter than Turner, and going to fat, but they had the same brown hair, very similar features. Turner paused on the stair when their eyes were level. "You still do a little bit of everything, Rudy? I need this kid scanned. I need a few other things, too." "Well," his brother said, "we'll see what we can do. We heard something last night, maybe a sonic boom. Anything to do with you?" "Yeah. There's a jet up by the squirrel wood, but it's pretty well out of sight." Rudy sighed. "Jesus. Well, bring her in." Rudy's years in the house had stripped it of most of the things that Turner might have remembered, and something in him was obscurely grateful for that. He watched the blonde crack eggs into a steel bowl, dark yellow free-range yolks. Rudy kept his own chickens. "I'm Sally," she said, whisking the eggs around with a fork. "Turner." "That's all he ever calls you either," she said. "He never has talked about you much." "We haven't kept all that much in touch. Maybe I should go up now and help him."
You sit. Your little girl's okay with Rudy. He's got a good touch.
Even when he's pissed?
Half pissed. Well, he's not going to operate. Just derm her and tape that ankle.
She crushed dry tortilla chips into a black pan over sizzling butter and poured the eggs on top.
What happened to your eyes, Turner? You and her...
She stirred the mixture with the chrome spatula, slopping in salsa from a plastic tub. G-force. Had to take off quick.
That how she hurt her ankle?
Maybe. Don't know.
People after you? After her?
Busy taking plates from the cabinet above the sink, the cheap brown laminate of the cabinet doors triggering a sudden rush of nostalgia in Turner, seeing her tanned wrists as his mother's. Probably, he said. I don't know what's involved, not yet.
Eat some of this.
Transferring the mixture to a white plate, rummaging for a fork.
Rudy's scared of the kind of people you might get after you.
Taking the plate, the fork, steam rising from the eggs. So am I.
Got some clothes, Sally said over the sound of the shower. Friend of Rudy's left them here. Ought to fit you.
The shower was gravity-operated, rainwater from a roof tank, a fat white filtration unit strapped into the pipe above the spray head. Turner stuck his head out between cloudy sheets of plastic and blinked at her. Thanks.
Girl's unconscious, she said. Rudy thinks it's shock, exhaustion. He says her crits are high, so he might as well run his scan now.
She left the room then, taking Turner's fatigues and Oki's shirt with her.
What is she?
Rudy, extending a crumpled scroll of silvery printout. I don't know how to read that, Turner said, looking around the white room, looking for Angie.
Where is she?
Sleeping. Sally's watching her.
Rudy turned and walked back the length of the room, and Turner remembered it had been the living room once.
Rudy began to shut his consoles down, the tiny pilot lights blinking out one by one.
I don't know, man. I just don't know. What is it, some kind of cancer?
Turner followed him down the room, past a work table where a micromanipulator waited beneath its dust cover. Past the dusty rectangular eyes of a bank of aged monitors, one of them with a shattered screen.
It's all through her head, Rudy said, like long chains of it. It doesn't look like anything I've ever seen, ever. Nothing.
How much do you know about biochips, Rudy?
Rudy grunted. He seemed very sober now, but tense, agitated. He kept running his hands back through his hair.
That's what I thought. It's some kind of, not an implant, graft.
What's it for?
For? Christ, who the fuck knows? Who did it to her? Somebody you work for?
Her father, I think.
Jesus.
Rudy wiped his hand across his mouth. It shadows like tumor on the scans, but her crits are high enough, normal. What's she like ordinarily?
Don't know. A kid. He shrugged.
Fucking hell, Rudy said. I'm amazed she can walk.
He opened a little lab freezer and came up with a frosted bottle of Moskovskaya.
Want it out of the bottle? He asked.
Maybe later.
Rudy sighed, looked at the bottle, then returned it to the fridge.
So, what do you want?
Anything as weird as what's in that little girl's head. Somebody's going to be after it soon, if they aren't already.
They are, Turner said. I don't know if they know she's here.
Yet.
Rudy wiped his palms on his grubby white shorts.
But they probably will, right?
Turner nodded.
Where are you going to go, then?
The sprawl.
Why?
Because I've got money there. I've got credit lines in 4 different names. No way to link them back to me. Because I've got a lot of other connections I may be able to use. And because it's always cover, the sprawl. So damned much of it, you know.
Okay, Rudy said. When?
You that worried about it? You want us right out?
No.
I mean, I don't know. It's all pretty interesting, what's in your girlfriend's head. I've got a friend in Atlanta could rent me a function analyzer, brain map, 1-to-1. Put that on her, I might start to figure out what that thing is. Might be worth something.
Sure, if you knew where to sell it.
Aren't you curious? I mean, what the hell is she? You pull her out of some military lab?
Rudy opened the white freezer door again, took out the bottle of vodka, opened it, and took a swallow. Turner took the bottle and tilted it, letting the icy fluid splash against his teeth. He swallowed, shuddered. It's corporate. Big. I was supposed to get her father out, but he sent her instead. Then somebody took the whole site out. Looked like a baby nuke. We just made it, this far. He handed Rudy the bottle. Stay straight for me, Rudy. You get scared, you drink too much. Rudy was staring at him, ignoring the bottle. Arizona, he said. It was on the news. Mexico's still kicking about it. But it wasn't a nuke. They've had crews out there all over. No nuke. What was it? They think it was a rail gun. They think somebody put up a hypervelocity gun in a cargo blimp and blew hell out of some derelict mall out there in the boonies. They know there was a blimp near there, and so far nobody's found it. You can rig a railgun to blow itself to plasma when it discharges. The projectile could have been damn near anything at those velocities. About 150 kilos of ice would do the trick. He took the bottle, capped it, and put it down on the counter beside him. All that land around there, it belongs to Mass Biolab, doesn't it? They've been on the news, Mass, cooperating fully with various authorities. You bet. So that tells us where you got your little honey from, I guess.
Sure. But it doesn't tell me who used the railgun, or why.
Rudy shrugged.
You better come see this, Sally said from the door.
Much later, Turner sat with Sally on the front porch. The girl had lapsed finally into something Rudy's EEG called sleep. Rudy was back in one of his workshops, probably with his bottle of vodka. There were fireflies around the honeysuckle vines beside the chain-link gate. Turner found that if he half-closed his eyes from his seat on the wooden porch swing, he could almost see an apple tree that was no longer there, a tree that had once supported a length of silvery-gray hemp rope and an ancient automobile tire. There were fireflies then as well, and Rudy's heels thumping a bare, hard skid of earth as he pumped himself out on the swing's arc, legs kicking, and Turner lay on his back in the grass, watching the stars.
Tongues, Sally said, Rudy's woman, from the creaking rattan chair, her cigarette a red eye in the dark. Talking in the tongues.
What's that?
What your kid was doing upstairs. You know any French?
No, not much, not without a lexicon.
Some of it sounded French to me.
The red amber was a short slash for an instant when she tapped ash. When I was little, my old man took me one time to this stadium, and I saw the testifying and the speaking in tongues. It scared me. I think it scared me more today when she started.
Rudy taped the end of it, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, Rudy hasn't been doing too good. That's mainly why I moved back in here. I told him I wasn't staying unless he straightened himself out, but then it got real bad, so about 2 weeks ago I moved back in. I was about ready to go when you showed up.
The coal of the cigarette arced over the railing and fell on the gravel that covered the yard.
Drinking?
That and the stuff he cooks for himself in the lab.
You know, that man knows a little bit of damn near everything. He's still got a lot of friends around the country. I've heard him tell stories about when you and him were kids, before you left.
He should have left, too, he said.
He hates the city, she said. Says it all comes in online anyway, so why do you need to go there?
I went because there was nothing happening here. Rudy could always find something to do. Still can, by the look of it.
You should have stayed in touch. He wanted you here when your mother was dying.
I was in Berlin. Couldn't leave what I was doing.
I guess not. I wasn't here then either. I came later. That was a good summer. Rudy just pulled me out of this sleaze-ass club in Memphis. Came in there with a bunch of country boys one night, and next day I was back here. Didn't really know why, except he was nice to me those days, and funny, and he gave my head a chance to slow down. He taught me to cook. She laughed. I liked that, except I was scared of those goddamn chickens out there. She stood up then and stretched, the old chair creaking, and he was aware of the length of her tanned legs, the smell and summer heat of her, close to his face. She put her hands on his shoulders. His eyes were level with the band of brown belly where her shorts rode low, her navel a soft shadow, and remembering Allison in the white hollow room, he wanted to press his face there, taste it all. He thought she swayed slightly, but he wasn't sure. "Turner," she said, "sometimes being here with him, it's like being here alone." So he stood, rattle of the old swing chain where the eye bolts were screwed deep in the tongue and groove of the porch roof, bolts his father might have turned 40 years before, and kissed her mouth as it opened, cut loose in time by talk and the fireflies and the subliminal triggers of memory, so that it seemed to him, as he ran his palms up the warmth of her bare back beneath the white T-shirt, that the people in his life weren't beads strung on a wire of sequence, but clustered like quanta, so that he knew her as well as he'd known Rudy, or Allison, or Conroy, as well as he knew the girl who was Mitchell's daughter. "Hey," she whispered, working her mouth free, "you come upstairs now."
18. Names of the Dead. Alain phoned at 5 and verified the availability of the amount he required, fighting to control the sickness she felt at his greed. She copied the address carefully on the back of a card she'd taken from Picard's desk in the Roberts Gallery. Andrea returned from work 10 minutes later, and Marley was glad that her friend hadn't been there for Alain's call. She watched Andrea prop up the kitchen window with a frayed blue-backed copy of the second volume of the Shorter Oxford English Dictionary, 6th edition. Andrea had wedged a kind of plywood shelf there on the stone ledge, wide enough to support the little hibachi she kept beneath the sink. Now she was arranging the black squares of charcoal neatly on the grate. "I had a talk about your employer today," she said, placing the hibachi on the plywood and igniting the greenish fire starter paste with the spark gun from the stove. "Our academic was in from Nice. He's baffled as to why I'd choose Josef Virek as my focus of interest, but he's also a horny old goat, so he was more than glad to talk." Marley stood beside her, watching the nearly invisible flames lick around the coals. "He kept dragging the Tessier ash pools into it," Andrea continued. "And Hughes. Hughes was mid to late 20th century, an American. He's in the book as well, as a sort of proto-Virek. I hadn't known that Tessier Ashpool had started to disintegrate." She went back to the counter and unwrapped 6 large tiger prawns. "They're Franco-Australian. I remember a documentary, I think. They own one of the big spas. Freeside. It's been sold now, my professor tells me. It seems that one of old Ashpool's daughters somehow managed to gain personal control of the entire business entity, became increasingly eccentric, and the clan's interests went to hell, this over the past 7 years. "I don't see what it has to do with Virek," Marley said, watching Andrea skewer each prawn on a long needle of bamboo. "Your guess is as good as mine. My professor maintains that both Virek and the Tessier ash pools are fascinating anachronisms, and that things can be learned about corporate evolution by watching them. He's convinced enough of our senior editors, at any rate." "But what did he say about Virek?" "That Virek's madness would take a different form."
"Madness?"
"Actually, he avoided calling it that. But Hughes was mad as birds, apparently, and old Ashpool as well, and his daughter totally bizarre. He said that Virek would be forced, by evolutionary pressures, to make some sort of jump
Jump was his word.
Evolutionary pressures?
Yes, Andrea said, carrying the skewered prawns to the hibachi. He talks about corporations as though they were animals of some kind. After dinner, they went out walking. Marley found herself straining at times to sense the imagined mechanism of Virek's surveillance, but Andrea filled the evening with her usual warmth and common sense, and Marley was grateful to walk through a city where things were simply themselves. In Virek's world, what could be simple? She remembered the brass knob in the Galerie du Perret, how it had squirmed so indescribably in her fingers, as it drew her into Virek's model of the Parque Güell. Was he always there, she wondered, in Gaudí's park, in an afternoon that never ended? Señor is wealthy. Señor enjoys any number of means of manifestation. She shivered in the warm evening air, moved closer to Andrea. The sinister thing about a Simstim construct, really, was that it carried the suggestion that any environment might be unreal, that the windows of the shop fronts she passed now with Andrea might be figments. Mirrors, someone had once said, were in some way essentially unwholesome. Constructs were more so, she decided. Andrea paused at a kiosk to buy her English cigarettes and the new L. Marley waited on the pavement, the pedestrian traffic parting automatically for her, faces sliding past, students and businessmen and tourists. Some of them, she assumed, were part of Virek's machine, wired into Paco. Paco, with his brown eyes, his easy way, his seriousness, muscles moving beneath his broadcloth shirt. Paco, who had worked for Señor all his life. What's wrong? You look as though you've just swallowed something. Andrea, stripping the cellophane from her 20 silk cut. No, Marley said and shivered, but it occurs to me that I very nearly did. And walking home, in spite of Andrea's conversation, her warmth, the shop windows had become boxes, each one, constructions, like the works of Joseph Cornell, or the mysterious boxmaker Virek sought, the books and furs and Italian cottons arranged to suggest geometries of nameless longing. And waking, once again, face smudged into Andrea's couch, the red quilt humped around her shoulders, smelling coffee, while Andrea hummed some Tokyo pop song to herself in the next room, dressing in a gray morning of Paris rain. No, she told Paco. I'll go myself. I prefer it. That is a great deal of money. He looked down at the Italian bag on the cafe table between them. It's dangerous, you understand.
There's no one to know I'm carrying it, is there? Only Alain. Alain and your friends. And I didn't say I'd go alone, only that I don't feel like company.
Is something wrong? The serious deep lines at the corners of his mouth. You are upset?
I only mean that I wish to be by myself. You and the others, whoever they are welcome to follow and observe. If you should lose me, which I think unlikely, I'm sure you have the address.
That is true, he said. But for you to carry several million new yen alone through Paris. He shrugged.
And if I were to lose it, would Señor register the loss? Or would there be another bag, another 4 million?
She reached for the shoulder strap and stood. There would be another bag, certainly, although it requires some effort on our part to assemble that amount of cash. And no, Señor would not register its loss in the sense you mean. But I would be disciplined even for the pointless loss of a lesser sum. The very rich have the common characteristic of taking care with their money, you will find.
Nonetheless, I go by myself. Not alone, but leave me with my thoughts.
Your intuition.
Yes.
If they followed, and she was sure they did, they were invisible as ever. For that matter, it seemed most likely that they would leave Alain unobserved. Certainly the address he had given her that morning would already be a focus of their attention, whether he were there or not. She felt a new strength today. She had stood up to Paco. It had had something to do with her abrupt suspicion the night before that Paco might be there, in part, for her, with his humor and his manliness and his endearing ignorance of art. She remembered Virek saying that they knew more about her life than she herself did. What easier way, then, for them to pencil in those last few blanks in the grid that was Marley Krushkova? Paco Esteves, a perfect stranger. Too perfect. She smiled at herself in a wall of blue mirror as the escalator carried her down into the metro. Pleased with the cut of her dark hair and the stylishly austere titanium frames of the black Porsche glasses she'd bought that morning. Good lips, she thought. Really, not bad lips at all. And a thin boy in a white shirt and dark leather jacket smiled at her from the up escalator, a huge black portfolio case beneath his arm. I'm in Paris, she thought. For the first time in a very long time, that alone seemed reason to smile. And today I will give my disgusting fool of a former lover 4,000,000 new yen, and he will give me something in return. A name, or an address, perhaps a phone number. She bought a first-class ticket. The car would be less crowded, and she could pass the time guessing which of her fellow passengers belonged to Virek. The address Alain had given her, in a grim northern suburb, was one of 20 concrete towers rising from a plain of the same material, speculative real estate from the middle of the previous century. The rain was falling steadily now, but she felt as though she were somehow in collusion with it. It lent the day something conspiratorial, and beaded on the chic rubber bag stuffed with Alain's fortune. How queer to stroll through this hideous landscape with millions beneath her arm, on her way to reward her utterly faithless former lover with these bales of new yen. There was no answer when she buzzed the apartment's numbered speaker button. Beyond smudged sheet glass, a darkened foyer, entirely bare. The sort of place where you turned the lights on as you entered. They turned themselves off again, automatically, invariably before your elevator had arrived, leaving you to wait there in the smell of disinfectant and tired air. She buzzed again. Alain? Nothing. She tried the door. It wasn't locked. There was no one in the foyer. The dead eye of a derelict video camera regarded her through a film of dust. The afternoon's watery light seeped in from the concrete plain behind her. Boot heels clicking on brown tile, she crossed to the bank of elevators and pressed button 22. There was a hollow thump, a metallic groan, and one of the elevators began to descend. The plastic indicators above the doors remained unlit. The car arrived with a sigh and a high-pitched, fading whine. Cher Alain, you have come down in the world. This place is the shits, truly. As the doors slid open on the darkness of the car, she fumbled beneath the Italian bag for the flap of her Brussels purse. She found the flat little green tin flashlight she'd carried since her first walk in Paris, with the lion-headed Pile Wonder trademark embossed on its front, and pulled it out. In the elevators of Paris you could step into many things, the arms of a mugger, a steaming pile of fresh dog shit, and the weak beam picking out the silver cables, oiled and shining, swaying gently in the vacant shaft. The toe of her right boot already centimeters past the scuffed steel edge of the tile she stood on. Her hand automatically jerking the beam down in terror, down to the dusty littered roof of the car two levels below. She took in an extraordinary amount of detail in the seconds her flash wavered on the elevator. She thought of a tiny submarine diving the cliffs of some deep seamount, the frail beam wavering on a patch of silt undisturbed for centuries, the soft bed of ancient furry soot, a dried gray thing that was a used condom, the bright reflected eyes of crumpled bits of tinfoil, the frail gray barrel and white plunger of a diabetic syringe. She held the edge of the door so tightly that her knuckle joints ached. Very slowly she shifted her weight backward, away from the pit. Another step and she clicked off her light. "Damn you," she said. "Oh, Jesus." She found the door to the stairwell. Clicking the little flashback on, she began to climb. 8 floors up, the numbness began to fade, and she was shaking, tears ruining her makeup. Rapping on the door again. It was pressboard, laminated with a ghastly imitation of rosewood, the lithographed grain just visible in the light from the long corridor's single strip of biofluorescence. Damn you! Allah! Allah! The myopic fisheye of the door's little spyglass looked through her, blank and vacant. The corridor held a horrible smell, embalmed cooking odors trapped in synthetic carpeting. Trying the door, knob turning, the cheap brass greasy and cold, and the bag of money suddenly heavy, the strap cutting into her shoulder. The door opening easily. A short stretch of orange carpet flecked with irregular rectangles of salmon pink. Decades of dirt ground into it in a clearly defined track by thousands of tenants and their visitors. Allah? The smell of black French cigarettes, almost comforting. And finding him there in that same watery light, silver light, the other tower blocks featureless, beyond a rectangle of window, against pale rainy sky, where he lay curled like a child on the hideous orange carpet, his spine a question mark beneath the taut back of his bottle-green velour jacket, his left hand spread above his ear, white fingers, faintest bluish tint at the base of his nails. Kneeling, she touched his neck. New. Beyond the window, all the rain sliding down, forever. Cradling his head, legs open, holding him, rocking, swaying, the dumb, sad animal keening filling the bare rectangle of the room. And after a time, becoming aware of the sharp thing under her palm, the neat, stainless end of a length of very fine, very rigid wire that protruded from his ear and between the spread cool fingers. Ugly. Ugly. That was no way to die. It got her up, anger, her hands like claws, to survey the silent room where he had died. There was no sense of him there. Nothing. Only his ragged attaché. Opening that, she found 2 spiral notebooks, their pages new and clean, an unread but very fashionable novel, a box of wooden matches, and a half-empty blue packet of Gauloises. The leather-bound agenda from Brown's was gone. She patted his jacket, slid fingers through his pockets, but it was gone. No, she thought. You wouldn't have written it there, would you? But you could never remember a number or an address, could you? She looked around the room again, a weird calm overtaking her. You had to write things down, but you were secretive, and you didn't trust my little book from Brown's, no. You'd meet a girl in some cafe and write her number in a matchbook or on the back of some scrap and forget it, so that I found it weeks later, straightening up your things. She went into the tiny bedroom. There was a bright red folding chair and a slab of cheap yellow foam that served as a bed. The foam was marked with a brown butterfly of menstrual blood. She lifted it, but there was nothing there. You'd have been scared, she said, her voice shaking with a fury she didn't try to understand, her hands cold, colder than Alain's, as she ran them down the red wallpaper, striped with gold, seeking some loose seam, a hiding place. You poor, stupid shit. Poor, stupid, dead shit. Nothing. Back into the living room, and amazed somehow that he hadn't moved, expecting him to jump up. Hello! Waving a few centimeters of trick wire. She removed his shoes. They needed resoling, new heels. She looked inside, felt the lining. Nothing. Don't do this to me. And back into the bedroom, the narrow closet, brushing aside a clatter of cheap white plastic hangers, a limp shroud of dry cleaner's plastic. Dragging the stained bed slab over and standing on it, her heels sinking into the foam, to slide her hands the length of a pressboard shelf and find, in the far corner, a hard little fold of paper, rectangular and blue. Opening it, noticing how the nails she'd done so carefully were chipped, and finding the number he'd written there in green felt pen. It was an empty Gauloise packet. There was a knock at the door. And then Paco's voice.
Marley?
Hello? What has happened? She thrust the number into the waistband of her jeans and turned to meet his calm, serious eyes.
It's Alain, she said. He's dead.
19. Hypermart. He saw Lucas for the last time in front of a big old department store on Madison Avenue. That was how he remembered him after that, a big black man in a sharp black suit, about to step into his long black car, one black softly polished shoe already on the lush carpet of Ahmed's interior, the other still on the crumbling concrete of the curb. Jackie stood beside Bobby, her face shadowed by the wide brim of her gold-hung fedora, an orange silk headscarf knotted at the back of her neck.
You take care of our young friend now, Lucas said, pointing the knob of his cane at her. He's not without his enemies, our Count.
Who is? Jackie asked.
I'll take care of myself, Bobby said, resenting the idea of Jackie being seen as more capable, yet at the same time knowing that she almost certainly was.
You do that, Lucas said, the knob swinging, lined up now with Bobby's eyes.
Sprawl Town's a twisty place, my man. Things are seldom what they seem.
To illustrate his point, he did something to the cane that caused the long brass splines below the ball to open smoothly for an instant, silently, extended like the ribs of an umbrella, each one glinting sharp as a razor, pointed like needles. Then they were gone, and Ahmed's wide door swung shut with an armor-plated thud.
Jackie laughed.
See it! Lucas still carrying that killing stick. Big-time lawyer now, but the street leaves a mark on you. Guess it's a good thing.
Lawyer?
She looked at him.
You never mind, honey. You just come with me. Do like I tell you. You'll be okay.
Ahmed merged with the sparse traffic, a pedicab jockey blaring pointlessly at the receding brass bumper with a handheld air horn. Then, one manicured gold-ringed hand on his shoulder, she led him across the sidewalk, past a sleeping huddle of rag-bundled trenchants, and into the slowly waking world of Hypermart. 14 floors, Jackie said, and Bobby whistled. All like this? She nodded, spooning brown crystals of rock sugar into the tan foam atop her coffee glass. They sat on scrolly cast-iron stools at a marble counter in a little booth, where a girl Bobby's age, her hair dyed and lacquered into a kind of dorsal fin, worked the knobs and levers of a big old machine with brass tanks and domes and burners and eagles with spread chrome wings. The countertop had been something else originally. Bobby saw where one end was bashed off in a long, crooked jag to allow it to fit between two green-painted steel pillars.
You like it, huh?
She sprinkled the foam with powdered cinnamon from a heavy old glass shaker. About as far from Berrytown as you've been, some ways. Bobby nodded, his eyes confused by the thousand colors and textures of the things in the stalls themselves. There seemed to be no regularity to anything, no hint of any central planning agency. Crooked corridors twisted off from the area in front of the espresso booth. There seemed to be no central source of lighting, either. Red and blue neon glowed beyond the white hiss of a Primus lantern, and one stall, just being opened by a bearded man with leather pants, seemed to be lit with candles, the soft light reflecting off hundreds of polished brass buckles hung against the reds and blacks of old rugs. There was a morning rattle to the place, a coughing and a clearing of throats. A blue Toshiba custodial unit whirred out of a corridor, dragging a battered plastic cart stacked with green plastic bales of garbage. Someone had glued a big plastic doll head to the Toshiba's upper body segment, above the clustered camera eyes and sensors. A grinning, blue-eyed thing, once intended to approximate the features of a leading stim star without violating SenseNet copyrights. The pink head, its platinum hair bound up in a length of pale blue plastic pearls, bobbed absurdly as the robot rolled past. Bobby laughed.
This place is okay, he said, and gestured to the girl to refill his cup.
Wait a sec, asshole, the counter girl said, amiably enough. She was measuring ground coffee into a dented steel hopper on one end of an antique balance.
"You get any sleep last night, Jackie, after the show?"
"Sure," Jackie said, and sipped at her coffee. "I danced their second set, then I slept at Jammer's. Hit the couch, you know." End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.